coming up as you have done from your background as the singer of Black Flag into the varied career that you've had, that you've created for yourself, you've made the most of things. And considering that and looking at the bigger picture of America, how do you see America still being called the land of opportunity today?
Well, it's been a land of opportunity for me. It's not always the land of opportunity for everyone. And I've been lucky, really lucky. And I'm also privileged to be heterosexual, white, male, and fairly educated in that high school diploma. And so a lot of doors open for me that would not necessarily open for other people of other ethnicities, sexual orientation, or economic strata. And that sucks, because that's not what the promise is. The promise is we're all equal and we're all going to get a share.
So given that, what's the true spirit of America that we don't often see here in Australia?
We are a lot like you all. Generous, very honest. That's how I found many Australians to be, very much like the people I grew up with in America. Forthright, come in through the front door, you state your business, people you'd like to share a country with. And anywhere you go in America, you will meet people who are so friendly, so real and honest and so generous. They'll give you a half of anything they have. And some people who are really, untoward. The America I try and dwell in is the one with, you know, friendly people. I'm not looking to get shot. You know, a lot of us, are shooting our guns off. It's an interesting country to be in because it could be so much better. My opinion is we don't live up to our promises, the promises that we're supposed to maintain and sustain in the Constitution. When you're originating documents, the Declaration of Independence, the preamble of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, like the seven articles and the first 10 amendments, were written by slave owners and those who benefited from slavery. If you have spent any meaningful time on the street, that would tell you that the grift was in from the beginning. In 1865, when the Civil War ended and we had the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery, you'd figure, well, here we go. Fresh page. Let's do this. Let's get it together. We didn't. What did you get? Jim Crow laws, segregation, the Ku Klux Klan getting unbelievable traction. And now it's in our politics. It's in our police forces. It's in our justice delivery systems. And so I think America's a broken machine with high hopes, but we didn't deliver. And so I try to be one who delivers. So I can't convince those who don't want to deliver to deliver.
So the reputation that America has abroad is essentially structurally engineered.
Well, I think some Americans live in this fallacy that we're exceptional and the world should do what we do. Like, really? You should stop calling the president of the United States a beep. You go online and read what people say about the president and his daughters and his wife. You're like, where are you from? Damn, you're from America. I share a country with this person who just said that about the president, because of the color of his skin. It used to really depress me until one day indifference set in. Not complete apathy, but you know what? You know, you're an adult. You know how you are. I can't convince you of anything. You know, maybe a few things, but I'm setting my ways, you're setting your ways. If you ever tried to say to me, global climate change is not real, I'm like, nah, I'm never, ever, ever going to believe you because I know I'm right. I'm not going to change the opinion of any homophobe in America, and that the homophobia, misogyny, and racism are like the things that get up my nose so fast and so hard. And I can't believe any of my American fellow citizens fall for it. But some guys are racist. There's nothing I can say to talk him down. I'm not wasting that 8 minutes of emailing the guy back from his hate mail where he threatened my life and called me a faggot lover for standing up for LGBT people. I can't change him, and I need the 8 minutes because I'm 55. Most of my life is behind me. And so what I have left, I really need to use it efficiently. And so my new attitude with America for the last few years is I'm not a patriot. Because I have to hang out with Ted Nugent and Sarah Palin, and I'm not going to do it.
So given your politics and given the amount of shows that you do, especially through America each and every year, who are the people that you're hoping will come and see your shows, and what do you think they'll get from it?
If I had my way, everyone who saw me play would bring someone, or saw me on stage, would bring someone who hadn't. So you're bringing new people in. Or maybe just every night would just be 700 or 1500 people who never saw me before, and somehow, I don't know, my friend said to go, so I'm going. Or I woke up in this chair. I don't know how I got here. I think it would be great to have as many new people as possible. Not saying that you should see me because I'm really great, but just hit people who haven't endured me before. Hit them with these these ideas and like just bring in new people and hell, make an impression.
Because you're not trying to win an argument when you do a show.
No, and I'm not trying to win followers and I'm not trying to be agreed with. I'm an adult. I can be disagreed with me just fine. And I don't particularly enjoy preaching to the converted because you're just going, hey, this sucks. And I was like, yeah, you just ran in place. Nothing happened. And so I don't dwell much on like homophobia is bad. I think everyone in my audience would go, yeah, thanks, Einstein. Next. And so I tell them, here's what happened when I was in Uzbekistan last November. Here's what happened when I was at the edge of the Antarctic Peninsula 3 months ago. And here's how these penguins looked at me. And here's what I learned in the rainforests of Ecuador about biodiversity. Or maybe it's inspiring. Someone will go, damn, I want to get a passport. I want to go. And so maybe the audiences walk out hearing a few new ideas and maybe just getting pumped up on life itself and be more invigorated not to be part of the problem.
And in regards to American culture, do you think that that similarly is narrowing like American politics as well? I get the idea that the multidiscipline that you have would be a lot harder to conjure these days for anyone in your position.
Yeah. We Americans, as you know, we don't travel very much. Many of us do not have a passport. We have amazing ideas about the Middle East and the African continent, about how these people conduct their lives. We often think they're really these stupid people scratching in the dirt, which is funny when these are cultures that invented math and were the first people to translate, languages into other languages and put them on tablets so other people could read what the other guy was writing, et cetera, et cetera. And so I live in a country that where a lot of people are scared. Their house is upside down. Their mortgage is in danger. Their job went to Honduras. They are adults with a family, and their concerns and fears are real. It's not rent. It's mortgage. It's not a girlfriend. It's marriage. It's not some kid. That's your kid. It's a lot of it is up for grabs. 2008, housing crisis. A lot of people found themselves homeless. There's American families living in Greyhound bus stations, feeding their kids candy bars from the machine. Come on. In a country like America, that's how people are. We need smarter people at the wheel, or people who are less corporatized, or people who are less shills for stockholders. And so I think when you say to an American who's being predated upon by their credit card company, by their landlord, worried about losing their job, when you say to them, hey, live and let live, read a book, I'll have to eat the four books I have before long. And so a lot of Americans are in a situation which is fairly terrifying.
So economy drives the culture and therefore lessens creativity.
But yeah, and lessens tolerance. Like, you know, if you're not having a happy life, you're way less open-minded to someone else's plight. Well, he's gay and he's being put upon. Well, then you'll tell him to suck it up. That's an attitude you might get if you're up against it. Instead of going, hey, man, he's gay. Let's not beat up on him because of that. When you're up against it, I'm not excusing bad behavior. I'm just saying it's harder to engender good behavior when your wallet's skinny and you're really scared. And that's what's happening to millions of Americans, hence the traction of Donald Trump.
Let's talk about your approach to spoken word. You do a lot of traveling. Are you the kind of guy who finds himself in so many different situations that the story essentially finds you? Or do you actually investigate an instance? Do you go in looking for something, you get a tingle about something, and you go in and have a good, closer look?
My usual MO, like say I'm in Nepal, I'm in Kathmandu. I leave the hotel with my camera. And I walk until I stop seeing Westerners. I just find streets and walk. What's going to happen? We'll have to find out. And you walk into something interesting. Like last time I was there, I walked into the communist general strike of Nepal. And I came back to the hotel and they said, what were you doing outside? You know, you're not supposed to leave. I said, I've been outside all day. They go, they're torching buildings. I went, oh, I saw a lot of hammer sickle flags being waved around. I thought it was a holiday. And they went, no, man, it's an insurrection. I'm like, well, it was cool. And so sometimes I find a story, or sometimes I just walk around and meet people and hang out in their yurt and see what that's like. And sometimes the story finds me. And so I find things all kinds of ways. But I'm always looking for a good photo op, for something interesting. So teach me something. Turn me on. And that's why I travel alone. So I just walk around and check stuff out.
And travel offers you that. I mean, everybody finds stories. Everybody yeah. brings home stories, but you take it home and you work on it, and you work alone a lot. So the work that you do on your own, at some point, are you mordantly aware that some of it sometime is going to have to turn into a performance in front of other people?
Yeah, but I go at that in a very pure way. Like, say, my last trip to Central Asia. I did a month of the backpack across all the stands. The stories I got was a sheer reportage after 3 months of, like, letting the dust settle. There's a lyric that comes from it. There's a melody from these people and these stories. And what hit stage after weeks of writing and distilling was the delicacy of the human intellect and how fragile we human creatures are. After watching so many wedding parties at so many mosques, the morning of the wedding, you see all those prearranged marriages and these two young people, bride and groom, are standing next to each other terrified. And you see these two 16-year-olds about to be married because their parents said, "You're marrying my uncle's daughter. Who is she? Your wife." And you see the terror on their faces and the uncomfortableness and the sadness. And I came back with a story about how fragile we creatures are, and we really need to not traumatize ourselves as much. That's what a month in Central Asia gave me. And so I come back knowing I'm going to report to my audience eventually. What that story is going to be must exceed, I saw this, this, and this. Because that's the statistics. That's just facts. Who cares? That's just... there's nothing to that. That's just a mere transference of images and information. I might as well just write it all down to you and send it to you as a free email and put in some JPEGs. I'm trying to find the wisdom in it, the steam that comes off the hot drink. That's not the drink itself, but it smells like the drink. And that's the magic I try to pull out of these trips.
It's really important in your spoken word shows to see things from the other way around.
I try, yeah. I mean, it's hard to be a Westerner and walk through the slums of Bangladesh and feel it, because I go back to the Westin Hotel, which I can see the entire time I'm in the Karel slum. And when I look down at the slum at night, there's no lights on. I'm like, there's the pool of darkness I was swatting mosquitoes in 3 hours ago. I'm not living in that. I'm living in this air-conditioned paradise, just back from the gym. And so I know where I am, and I know that I'm not from there. And so I try not to be a voyeur. I'm trying to get non-Western experiences to Western audiences so they can understand better the world in which they live in, that they're not isolated, that we share water systems and weather systems, economies, and a love of life.
Is that hard to do or easier to do considering your own Western baggage?
I have a lot of Western baggage. And over many trips, I have learned to at least compartmentalize it and not be so Western all the time when I'm walking through these places. Like, wow, that garbage picker, how sad. That's a Western evaluation of that person. That person's not sad. He or she, that's their job. And I'm not trying to be a tough guy. I'm just saying they're not sorry for themselves. When you walk up, wow, are you okay? They're like, yeah, I'm okay. Are you okay? Get away from me. I'm working. And when you see that kind of active poverty, they don't know they're poor. They're just, this is life. Someone might look at me and go, wow, your life sucks. And I go, I don't know. It seems okay to me. It is what it is. And that took me several trips to Africa and India to lose all of that. Wow, that's a body on fire. That's insane. No, it's not. It's just how they voulez-vous. And once you can get there, then your photos become better. Your conversations with people become better. And the stories that I put on stage become analog, true human-to-human exchanges. That's what I try for.
You mentioned being a tough guy back there. You're a pretty confident guy, but you also mentioned the fragility of human intellect. How's the fragility of yours day-to-day?
Very fragile. I'm a very neurotic person. It's easy for you to get to me. I'm not a tough guy. And not to disagree with you, but I'm not a confident person at all. I'm so glad I'm not confident. Because I don't want to be confident on stage. I want to be desperately trying not to screw it up. I want to be like, don't screw this up. Keeps me leaning into it.
So when you're sitting there with a blank piece of paper at your desk day after day, how do you push through to get the work done?
Oh, that never happens. I don't do writer's block. So kids write me, "Hey, Henry, I'm a writer." Uh-huh. "I have writer's block. How do I get through it?" I go, throw out the idea that you're a writer. You're not. F. Scott Fitzgerald and Camus, those were writers. You're a kid with a laptop. I'm an ass. I'm an old idiot with a notepad. I've never thought I was a writer because I've read too much F. Scott Fitzgerald to ever swallow that illusion. So there's days I write and there's days I don't write. It's not a writer's block. It's just one day I write, one day I don't. I'm not running a race. It's a marathon. I'm going to write till I die. And so throw out the notions of being a writer, and you'll throw out the notions of having writer's block.
So without using a cliche, you just have to do it.
Just get on with it.
It's got nothing to do with confidence.
No, I don't do confidence. I don't have any. I just have desperation to succeed or get it done, or a willingness to confront. To me, to be confident is to lack, there's an awareness or three that you would be throwing out. I can do anything. I don't ever think that.
So what word should we be using instead of confidence to get through the day and to make sure that
for me
we're successful?
I'm pulling it from the I Ching. Resolve, not ambition, resolve. Throw out your ambition, put in resolve. Like, I'm going to do this. Just say, I'm not going to stop. I'm going to try not to stop. It hurts. My pack is heavy. I'm going to try and get to the top of the mountain. I'm resolved to doing that. I'm going to see it through.
I think that sort of shows in one of the fundamentals of your show, where you have a lot of empathy and sympathy. I think they're the core values of any story that you tell. It is about looking at things from the other way around. There's a lot of comedy in there as well, but you're not strictly a comedian, of course. But do you think a lot of comedy that you seem to get linked with lacks these qualities and could be better served or serve us better that way? Because I know that with your shows, you're looking to serve us in some way.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. No, I'm a service module. I only look to serve. That's a huge word in my vocabulary. Serve, serving, service. I'm a yogurt machine. Just like you hit the thing, the thing comes out, and that's it. I'm a Coke machine. I vend. I just, things come out. That's all I wanted. I just want to give you. I don't want anything from you, except maybe 2 hours of your time every 4 years. Otherwise, I just want to output. I think some comedians, the really great ones, do find empathy in their humor. They do find these wonderful analog human moments, like Patton Oswalt, who's amazing. He's so funny. He's such a sweetheart. He hits hard, but he hits smart. And you, like Bill Hicks, he hit hard. And the people he pounced on needed pouncing on, like the Bush administration, the first one. And he came down hard on that stuff, as well he should. He came down on Christian hypocrisy and homophobia, et cetera, et cetera. And man, Bill Hicks never missed, in my opinion. He was a sharpshooter. But there's a lot of humanity where he'd like make fun of himself. Like, you know, when he talks about porn, he's talking about the 80 million times he's rented the one lesbian porn video, which the title I won't repeat. But it's funny. And he always puts himself as the butt of the joke. And I think some comedians achieve that. Some of them are just mean. And I can't do mean. And as I've grown older, maybe I'm just getting softer. I don't know, or maybe more aware. When I was younger, you'd see some girl all decked out in some wacky clothes. And you're like, that's a lot of work. And when I see someone like that now, I'm like, she's just trying to look pretty. She's just wanting to be in the mix. Like, you can't put her down. Like, in my country, I don't know about here. I'm no expert on Australia. But we have, you know, fat shaming and all these, like, you know, you should wear a burqa because you look stupid in that bikini because you're too fat. Oh, because I don't starve myself and live on cigarettes. And that body shaming thing, like, why are you wearing that? Because I'm a woman. I want to buy a bikini. Bite me. I mean, no one's getting hurt here. And the vitriol that gets spewed upon these people, the body shaming, the victim blaming, like, she got raped at a party. What was she doing at the party with a short skirt? Hey, man, like, that's the wrong conversation to be having about this. Like, you are part of the problem with that conversation. And the older I get, the more hyper-aware I become of all that stuff. And the more I want to call it out and go, hey, you know, you're a good person, but you're wrong about that. The thing you said about that person, that's not where we need to be going.